You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 17th of November 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
Coming up on today's programme, we focus on the photography exhibitions currently showing in London. Focus, photography, champagne script writing. We don't just crank this stuff out, you know.
Indeed we don't. We'll also survey cultural events occurring around the world in general and in Buenos Aires in particular.
For Shakespeare fans, the ongoing production of Macbeth at the Teatro San Martin is not to be missed. Seen the Bard's plays in English, now it's time to see if it works in Spanish or gets lost in translation.
Our music review will consider the choices of Mixcloud co-founder Nikhil Shah.
And we'll also be guided around the installations of the Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival and Sonica in Glasgow by a man named Igor.
That wasn't Igor. Igor uses words. Lots to look forward to ahead on this week's edition of The Review here on Monocle 24. Indeed there is, and welcome to Midori House. You are listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Emma Nelson. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Muller. We have an hour ahead of us, which I wouldn't necessarily argue is very easy listening this week. Normally we do have some quite pleasant sounds, but I think we're going to be challenging the listeners, especially in the installation section later on.
Especially because the installation section, obviously this being radio, we cannot provide you with the visual accompaniments.
So we'll be trying to describe sounds and pictures at the same time. It is one of those things that you always think that radio is simple because it is just the exploration of sound. But when you get to something like a sound installation, you suddenly realise that you need to be able to see things as well. It's absolutely baffling in terms of the way that you negotiate your way around
this. It is, because in that menu clip, what is obviously at some level intended to be a meaningful and profound work of art did sound rather like a monkey with a typewriter.
A bit clattery. But in fact, when you do see it, it looks a bit like a large version of a typewriter that's making the noise.
No monkeys are involved.
No monkeys involved, thank goodness.
Which, and we also have... my mind is a shame, frankly.
We also have Nikhil Shah coming in, who's he's a co-founder of the website Mixcloud, and his choice of music as well. None of that is particularly easy to listen to either.
Not really, no. Quite a lot of it does sound like the sort of thing you often hear being played loudly from small cars in suburban shopping precincts.
But dear listener, don't be put off by the next 60 minutes of challenging listening. Embrace it. We're also going to be talking photography too, which is possibly something which is challenging too, but may not make you want to immediately step back and run away. Andrew and I went to the Victoria and Albert Museum this week to have a look at their new exhibition, a small exhibition, which is focusing on contemporary photography from the Middle East. And in just a moment, we will be joined by Diane Smith, who's deputy editor of the British Journal of Photography, to discuss what I think is a sort of a swathe of photography exhibitions, which seems to have taken over London in the last couple of months.
There does seem to be a lot of it about.
Indeed. Let's press on. You are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24.
There is, as we just discussed, a veritable plethora of photography exhibitions open in London at the moment, including the small but intermittently gripping New Light from the Middle East show at the V&A and the somewhat perplexing Seduced by Art exhibition at the National Gallery.
So to discuss this wave of photography, as I mentioned a moment ago, I'm delighted to say we're joined in the studio by Diane Smith, who's deputy editor of the British Journal of Photography. A very warm welcome to Monocle 24, Diane. Like we said a moment ago, there does seem to be an awful lot of photographic exhibitions around. Is this just typical of London? And is this a reintroduction to the world of the photographic genre, or has it just never been? Has it never gone away?
I think maybe photography is being accepted now in London in a way that it hasn't been before. The Tate Modern quite famously didn't show a major photography exhibition until 2003. But a couple of years ago, they appointed a curator of photography, Simon Baker. One of the big shows that's on at the moment is down to him, Dado Moriyama, William Klein. And I think that he has helped to spearhead a new movement for photography exhibitions in art galleries in London.
Why have people been so reticent?
I think perhaps because photography isn't just an art, it's also used in magazines, it's used in advertising, and everyone takes photographs. So it hasn't always necessarily been seen as something that's, fit for galleries. Perhaps there's been some snobbishness in the past.
Is it perhaps also arguable that now advances, or at least changes in photographic techniques, bring it closer to art, now that you can, photography... You can see the argument if you think that photography is basically just journalism, but now you can actually make cameras do anything. The downside being that you can't actually trust pictures anymore, but the upside being, I guess, that it does move photography more into the realm of creative art.
Well, yes and no. Photography has always been manipulated. The
Fair
Cecil
enough.
Beaton exhibition that's on at the moment at the Imperial War Museum makes it quite clear that he manipulated some of the images that he showed and retouched them. But it is easier to retouch now, perhaps, than it was in the past. I don't know if it's down to the technology behind photography, because you could also argue that photography is easier now than ever. Everyone's got a camera on their phone. So I don't know if the craft aspect of it is so important. It's more of an attitudinal change, I'd say.
Looking at a change in attitude, the exhibition at the National Gallery, Seduced by Art, which is modern photographers takes on classic pieces of classic portraits and what have you. The critic Brian Sewell, not one for holding back, used this as an opportunity to say that no matter how hard you try, photography still isn't art and never shall be. Why are their voices still saying this?
I think that exhibition at the National Gallery is quite interesting because it's the first exhibition that's, predominantly been about photography. But it also does show a slight reticence towards the medium in that it pairs photographs with paintings. So again, I feel it is trying to make a case for photography as an art form rather than just saying, photography is here, it's got an exhibition, it can be in galleries, it can also be in newspapers, and that's what's special about the medium in a way.
It does seem like a reversal of that incredibly faint praise with which you can damn a painting, doesn't it? That, wow, it looks just like a photograph.
Yeah.
Let's move on to some of the exhibitions that we've been talking about this week. We've talked about Seduced by Art several times here on The Review, and that's ongoing until early next year. In a moment, we'll talk about the Middle East show at the V&A, but you wanted to talk about the Cartier-Bresson exhibition called A Question of Colour, currently on at Somerset House in the centre of London. A really unusual name for an exhibition, because Cartier-Bresson famously hated colour.
Yeah, it's a really great exhibition and I really recommend it to anyone. And also it's free, which is fantastic.
What's it about?
It's about Cartier-Bresson. It takes 10 of his black and white photographs. He's kind of known for having been anti-colour, but perhaps I can discuss that in a bit. It compares the 10 photographs that he's taken with colour photographs that photographers after him have taken, which kind of are in the spirit of Cartier-Bresson. They have a kind of feel for his decisive moment, a moment of spontaneity, where form and content unite. I think it's quite a good sort of headline for the exhibition that Cartier-Bresson hated colour, and here are these photographers who say that they follow him but they use colour. But actually it's a little bit more complicated than that. Cartier-Bresson was working when colour photography was in its infancy, and it was quite a slow film at that stage, which meant that you often had to do colour photography in a studio in quite a static way. So for a photographer like him, who was interested in kind of the immediacy of the moment, perhaps colour photography wasn't the right way to go at that time. So perhaps now, if he was around and he could see the films and also the digital cameras, perhaps he'd be a bit more enthusiastic about colour photography now. But having said all that, I think it's a really interesting exhibition because it puts the emphasis so much on the form of photography. There's photographs from all over the world, but what's important is thinking about the way that colour affects a photograph and the way that that affects the form, and comparing them to the black and white photographs by Bresson, Cartier-Bresson.
It is quite difficult to have an exhibition like that without immediately thinking that rather hackneyed question, what would he think now?
Yeah, that's true. Of course, we've got no way of knowing. Bill Ewing is the curator of the exhibition, and he's got a quote by Cartier-Bresson saying that we must continue to feel our way. So, you know, obviously I'm speaking for someone who can't speak for himself, but perhaps he was a bit more open-minded than the headline suggests.
There have been some criticisms of the Seduced by Art exhibition at the National, which says that it actually makes the photographic genre look weak when you compare it to painted art. Does this exhibition, the Somerset House exhibition, have the same effect on making colour look weaker than black and white, or how does it work?
I wouldn't say that at all. It's divided into, I think it's 6 rooms, each of which has a black and white photo by Cartier-Bresson, and then colour images that kind of relate to them, and some of them quite directly. For example, the exhibition opens with a photograph of a woman on the street by Cartier-Bresson, and then there's 2 images afterwards, one by Joel Meyerowitz and another one by Saul Leiter, which also show women in the street. So it's kind of hung salon style, mixing up different years to emphasise some of the similarities and also the differences between the colour and the black and white. So I think it's more of a compare and a contrast. It doesn't make one look better than the other.
What's Cartier-Bresson's commitment to black and white? Do you think it was exclusively a stand on aesthetic principle, or was he the sort of photographic equivalent of one of those deracinated literary grouches who insists on writing his novels with a pen and paper?
I mean, maybe it's a bit of both. Colour photography was seen as a bit vulgar, famously, by Walker Evans as late as 68. But Cartier-Bresson, he thought it was in its infancy. So perhaps he wasn't too enthusiastic about the aesthetics, but that's bound up in the technique. And he did actually use colour photography as well as kind of a punchline at the end of the exhibition, that they have some vitrines with Life magazine from 1958, which has got a colour shoot that Cartier-Bresson did in China. And you can kind of see his point. The detail isn't fantastic in the colour images, but what it does get across is the red stars and the soldiers' hats and the red flags and the Chairman Mao little red book. So his use of colour is quite interesting, I'd say, in those photographs.
Let's move on to an exhibition that's on at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London at the moment. The theme is, it's a small exhibition which talks about and examines the idea of contemporary Middle Eastern photography. And as we have been talking in the last few moments, there's a push now to questioning the way that photographs tell a story. And this seems to be at the heart of this exhibition. What did you think of the exhibition?
I thought the exhibition's a mix of good and bad. It covers 13 countries with 30 artists, which is obviously a vast geographical area, and it's quite difficult to represent all of those countries in really a relatively small exhibition. And some countries are, you know, not represented at all. Some have just got one photographer. Like, for example, there's only one Turkish photographer in the exhibition. On the other hand, there are like 9 or 10 photographers from Iran. So I thought perhaps, I mean, the exhibition has been put together to show off a new collection of Middle Eastern art, which is shared by the V&A and the British Museum. So perhaps, you know, there are some politics behind, they have to show off a range from that collection. But I almost felt that there was kind of a more interesting exhibition within the exhibition that's kind of fighting to get out, which is to do with how images are used in the Middle East and how contemporary artists respond to that. So, I mean, the exhibition opens with a kind of, there's a stylistic breakdown into 3 different rooms. And in the first room, they look at photographers who use photographs to record, which, number one, I found a bit problematic because, you know, a camera takes a picture, so what? And it combines both documentary photography and also staged photographs. But of the documentary photographs that they have, they're all in Iran, and they tend to show scenes where photographs are in the picture that's been taken, be that on a soldier's T-shirt or be that pictures of a leader being burnt. So a photograph of a leader being burnt.
And also there's in one of the pictures, there's the presence of the photographer herself within the photograph. It's in an Iranian wrestling gym, which... The spiel on the side of the photograph says that this is an unusual picture because no breath of a woman is allowed inside these places. But so you have the image ostensibly of the wrestler training, and it seems like he's in his own self-enclosed space. And then you see her unauthorised presence, you know, the unauthorised presence of a photographer in her own picture, but also her physical presence in the room.
Yeah.
And I found that the most interesting section of that reportage, because the rest of the pictures, you say most of them are in Iran, I found very, very hackneyed, very trite. Yes, there are pictures of girls with, you know, girls in burqas with machine guns, that kind of stuff, which you think, we've seen this before.
There is a very established cliche of Middle Eastern photography, and it does check all those boxes, especially those Iranian photos from the revolution in 1979. It's the angry men with beards, the women in burqas, and also there's that whole ancient versus modern thing, which is it's the first thing you notice when you walk out of the terminal in Tehran, and it's just the most obvious thing to point out.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it was an unusual choice to include the Abbas pictures of the revolution because they're from, you know, 78, 79, whereas the rest of the exhibition is predominantly from the last 10 years or so. So I wondered why they did include those images, actually.
I did like some of the doctored ones, those ones, and I forget the artist's name, of the Egyptian soldiers with the from Tahrir Square transposed into sort of weird, lurid postcard
Alpine
locations.
Images of freshness, purity, leisure, and lightness.
And also emphasising, I think, how out of place the soldiers felt, because that's always an awkward moment in any revolution when the army in the middle of it can't really decide which way their gun should be pointing. I really like those.
Yeah, I like those images too. I think maybe for me, the way that it's presented is part of the problem. In the catalogue to the exhibition, there's an essay by Venetia Porter, who, rather than trying to break things down with a formal structure, looking at whether artists record things or whether they sort of interrogate the photograph, she looks more at the cultural background in which the images are produced, and kind of perhaps something that's not brought out in the exhibition but obviously is very relevant is the status of photography in the Middle East. There's a couple of images which touch on the fact that portrait studios were maybe closed in certain countries in certain eras. And I think perhaps it's quite a political issue, so maybe it's difficult for the gallery to present those questions in the exhibition, but they are very relevant and it is there. It's just that it's kind of hidden away.
Along similar lines, one of those countries where photography of any sort, especially portrait photography, has obviously been problematic as Afghanistan. I did like those shots, those very small ones of Kabul taken through one of the box cameras, which I remember from visiting Kabul in the late 90s. It was the only photography allowed, was these street corner vendors with these antique contraptions which took those wonderful washed out silvery pictures. I really liked those.
Yeah.
What I find quite problematic about the exhibition is that the further I went into it, the less I was aware that these were Middle Eastern photographers. Obviously, this is something that is this is an aspect that the V&A is trumpeting, saying, you know, this is stuff from inside the region. But it felt like it was curated in an incredibly Western, external way. It imposed a sort of Western set of values on these photographs. And it did make you feel as if you were, you know, the great idea of Orientalism, the other. You did feel as if this was, well, this is how we're going to depict what we think Middle Eastern artists should be looking like and should be portraying. What do you think of that?
I think the fact that it's limited to artists, like maybe it would be quite interesting to look at more contemporary ways that photography is used in the Middle East. For example, over the Arab Spring, images were an important part of the messages that went around. There's the famous Nader video from Iran, which to me is really important footage from the early 21st century. And so it might have been interesting to widen the remit just a bit beyond just art photography and some of the very formal concerns of the exhibition to look more at the culture and the region and the geography.
It didn't feel very contemporary when there are three rooms to this, and I felt like we needed a fourth one because it seemed to be completely oblivious of the last, five, 6 years of history. And so much has happened and so much is currently happening that I felt that we should have had a fourth room, that you'd almost want to change the content daily to say this is what's coming out of the Middle East at the moment.
Yeah.
It felt like it belonged in the past and it was quite disappointing in that way.
Yeah, I mean, there are some contemporary images, that the images you mentioned earlier about the Egyptian soldiers who are transposed into idyllic settings, they're taken from 2011. But obviously, that's still a year ago, and I think perhaps that's part of the fact that it's art photography that comes up through the galleries, so there tends to be a bit of a lag between current events and the ways that they're represented.
Diane Smith of the British Journal of Photography, thank you very much for joining us here on The Review. And don't forget, next week's Culture Show is all about photography, including an interview with the curator of the Middle Eastern Photography Exhibition at the V&A, Marta Weiss. So to hear her side of the coin, tune in at 1900 hours, London time on Monday.
You're listening to The Review after this short break. We'll be hearing about some highlights for the weekend from Monocle's Associate Editor, Nelly Gocheva.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes, and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks, and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
Our weekly music review is up ahead, but first, Nelly Gocheva, Monocle's Associate Editor, joins us from Toronto with some cultural tips for the weekend, wherever you are in the world and wherever you might prefer to be.
This weekend in Paris, Beaux-Arts Grand Palais welcomes the annual Paris Photo Exhibition. Since 1996, Paris Photo has offered a platform for artists, curators, and galleries to discuss, enjoy, and snap up each other's work. As well as enjoying the works by over 1,000 artists, visitors can also attend critical discussions from architects and filmmakers on the future of photography. If you missed this Paris Photo installment, then look out for the Photo Los Angeles exhibition in April next year. For more information, go to parisphoto.com. The Museum of Contemporary Canadian Art is hosting an exhibition of works by previous recipients of the Sobey Art Award, including Daniel Barrow, Tim Lee, and Michel Dubrun. Organized in collaboration with the National Gallery of Canada, the show features drawings, photography, sculpture, and video installations focusing on contemporary art production in Canada. The Sobey Art Award was established in 2002 and celebrates its 10th anniversary this year. In London, fashion label Hermès has collaborated with Paris-based digital artist Miguel Chevalier for the brand's menswear boutique in Selfridge's Wonder Room. The interactive installation, named Eight Ties, is laid out on 8-meter-long walls. It uses Chevalier's signature symbols, the USB icon, on and off switch, and the cable jack, and it redefines Hermes silk ties on a virtual reality. Miguel Chevalier's Eight Ties installation is on until the 2nd of December. The Art Court Gallery in Osaka welcomes the exhibition Natural Folk Textiles by Japanese artist Shihoko Fukumoto. Through the craft of shibori, ringing fabrics, and bokashi, blending the colors, Fukumoto creates her art on woven hemp and cotton canvases, converging art and design. Natural Folk Textiles is on until the 24th of November. For your weekend soundtrack, we recommend Our House on the Hill by The Babies. Brooklyn's alternative folk rockers are back with their second album that continues the retro-acoustic guitar pop sound of their eponymous first album. Our House on the Hill is available to buy now. Let's hear Mess Me Around. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
And from Brooklyn, that was The Babies and Mess Me Around, ending our report from Nelly Gotcheva. You're listening to The Review.
We're staying on the topic of music, moving seamlessly along. It's time for our weekly music review. And this week, our guest is Nikhil Shah, who's the co-founder of online music service Mixcloud and part of the music collective Man Make Music. He joins us in the studio now. Good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon.
First of all, before we get into your music choices, tell us a bit about Mixcloud. How did that start?
Yeah, sure. It started about 4 years ago, born out of a personal frustration. Myself and my co-founder, we studied together at university. We had a radio show. We did this in a, you know, kind of basement, dingy student radio station. CUR 1350, it was called. Cambridge University Radio. It was a lot of fun. We, you know, we learnt a bit about radio, but we had a great time and we got really interested in discovering music through radio. And we were very frustrated with the state of play on the internet. There's so much fantastic content out there, but it's really fragmented and we wanted to fix this. So I boldly quit my job 4 years ago and embarked on an amazing journey. And we've now got a fantastic community of, you know, DJs, radio stations, radio presenters all over the world uploading great content to our platform.
It sounds a very romantic, lovely idea, connecting your radio shows, your DJs and your podcasts with listeners and also people who want to participate in the music. It's very romantic, but how do you fund it? And how do you make it work financially?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I think actually for our business, more interesting than most, because as a digital, you know, as a tech startup, we've never raised venture money or angel investment, which is quite unique. So we have a fairly, you know, we are quite idealistic in terms of the idea. And as a team, you know, we did the very cliched startup in a warehouse thing for about 2 years. We lived and worked in a massive warehouse in Stonebridge Park. As you know, you might have heard of this Guardian scheme where you look after a building instead of living in it as a tenant. So, you know, we kept our costs down. We just focused on building a service that people really loved. We got a bit of help from the government, actually. So we managed to get 3 grants now from the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills. And we then focused on building a business model that works. We now work with fantastic advertisers and brands all over the world to help them connect to our audience.
And it does seem... Sorry.
Sorry, have you got any closer to grasping that holy grail that the music business has been searching for since somebody first switched on the World Wide Web? Like, basically, how do we make money by giving something away?
It's a big challenge, and you know I'm not going to pretend that we have found a solution. We don't describe ourselves as a music business. We are a radio platform, and what we do is we give our creators a platform to distribute their content to a global audience, and we find a way to monetize it. Currently, to cover the cost of royalties, to cover the costs of running the business, and you know our holy grail is actually to find a way to monetize the DJs that use the service as well.
That is one of the key things, though, is the participation of the DJs in websites like this. I'm thinking also of the likes of SoundCloud, where people take tracks, remix them, and then post them back up again. One of the difficulties I find with websites like that is great idea, but you get everybody having a go at remixing stuff and putting their own tunes up on the website. And as a result, you are wading through some great stuff, but you're wading through some dross as well. How do you do a quality control there?
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge. And it's quite ironic because the problem we set out to solve was to help people navigate this really complex, fragmented world of radio online. And because we've managed to build such a massive catalogue, we have 300,000 people uploading content to our platform now. We've actually created another problem, which is how do you filter through the volume of content? And we're not going to pretend that there is a silver bullet and one single approach. We have a suite of different features and different tools that allow different types of users to navigate the way that they want. So it might be through social. Social is a very big part of our service. We've got a great partnership with Facebook, and we do a lot of things to help people discover content through their friends. There are algorithms to pull out the most popular. And there are, you know, lots of different, we focus a lot on metadata. So you can search by lots of different parameters, tags. You can look at different artists and see which DJs are playing them.
And as a result, you're talking about how to sift out the bad stuff. How do you ensure with your algorithms or whatever that the good new stuff comes through? Because when I encountered Mixcloud for the first time, I found myself searching for the old names of the DJs simply because I knew that I would get something of high quality. How do you ensure that the quality floats to the surface?
Our perspective on this as a business is that we don't have a view on quality, right? Because we have no idea. We have listeners from every single country in the world. We have people uploading everything from abstract techno to, avant-garde folk. We don't know what quality is. And actually, I'm a firm believer in human curation over algorithms. So, it's up to the people to decide. And actually, the community decides by listening. And the more something gets listened to, the more we believe it is popular and quality.
Well, of the probably infinite number of tracks available through your service, you've chosen three for us to listen to today.
It was hard.
introduce the first of you. This is Kendrick Lamar, who, of course, comes from Compton, if I've done my homework right, the sort of the heartland, if you will, of modern hip-hop. Tell us a bit about him.
Yeah, So I was travelling in the States earlier this year, an awesome trip. I went to South by Southwest, Miami Winter Music Conference, and a short stop over in LA for the first time in my life. And I kind of fell in love with hip-hop again on this trip. I've always been a massive, massive hip-hop fan. It was probably one of my first loves, especially as a DJ. I just haven't really been excited by it for the last few years, and I've been getting a lot more into electronic music. But this trip over to the States and kind of hanging out in LA, listening to the new sounds of hip hop, just made sense. It really fitted in the atmosphere and the vibe of that city. And Kendrick Lamar, he's got a new album out at the moment, which is, a lot of people, most of my friends are saying it's their favorite album of the year, for sure. And so this is a track off his first album, which I fell in love with at the start of this year. And yeah.
Okay, let's hear some of it. This is the
it's the Spiteful Chant.
The Spiteful Chant, and indeed it is.
When I was sleeping on couches, nigga couldn't get a car, just a Glock for my voucher. Nigga, I was motherfucking out here. But the flashing lights had me stuck like reindeer when I should have been making bang gears. I was somewhere stuck with a flame here. Motherfucker, see how far that I came here. Went broke and I came up in the same year.
And that's Kendrick Lamar, The Spiteful Chant, the music choice of Nikhil Shah, co-founder of the online music service Mixcloud. Nikhil, when we introduced today's programme, we said that we were going to be playing people some quite hard listens. That has anger and swagger to it. The video, if anyone has the opportunity to go and see it, is quite astonishing. It's got a sort of medieval battle cry inside it. But it isn't an easy listen, but it's channeling stuff from the 1990s, the likes of Tupac and Notorious B.I.G.
Mm. Yeah, it's not easy at all. It's definitely got that anger of, West Coast 90s hip-hop, but it's mixed in with this kind of really, really interesting futuristic electronic production. If you listen to the rest of the album, you'll hear it's just got a real modern take. And that's why it's such a great sound for me.
I read an interview with him, and he's already touting himself as the new Jay-Z. That's obviously got great swagger to it, a claim like that. How much do you actually need longevity while staying alive? Because, many of them who became legendary ended up getting shot.
Well, I don't know about many. Obviously, there's two key cases.
But his main influences are the ones who ended up being the victim of a very, very dirty and nasty world.
Yeah, in terms of your comments about his big claims of being the next Jay-Z, I think that's just a hip-hop thing, right? And that's I think why hip-hop is very interesting as a genre, because they're not afraid to be bold. They're not afraid to stake their claims as being the next greatest artist on the planet. And It's kind of refreshing, actually, in an age, especially as a Brit.
It fits in with the music as well. It would seem weird if a new hip hop artist just sort of made this statement of intent. I'm going to do my best.
Yeah.
I hope everybody likes it.
But do you find that hip hop has to renew itself only in that way? That it has to be angry and it has to have some swagger in order for it to sort of differentiate itself from mainstream softer music.
I don't think so. If you listen to what the kind of stuff that Kendrick raps about, it's not necessarily kind of cash, money, hoes in the same way that some of the 90s hip-hop artists were rapping about. It's gritty, it's more real. You listen to someone like Tyler, the Creator, and Odd Future, it's just, they're getting a bit more abstract as well. And there's definitely it's a movement away from materialism into like life.
Okay, well, I want to cue up the next track you've picked, which is a collaborator of yours, I believe, George Fitzgerald.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Tell us a bit about this one.
Yeah, sure. So George is a very dear friend. We studied together at university. We were DJing together from, you know, kind of... In fact, the first time I met him, I was DJing at his college event. He was a fresher. I was a third year, I believe. And he spent the whole night hating on me because I don't think he enjoyed my music. That turned into a very fruitful relationship. So I think if you want to form a relationship with someone, always start with controversy is a firm belief of mine.
The underpinning of any number of romantic comedies. let's hear the song. This is George Fitzgerald with Child.
And that's George Fitzgerald and Child, the choice of Nikhil Shah, the co-founder of online music service Mixcloud. Time is not on our side today, Nikhil, but very briefly, when I heard that, I thought this has this sort of muted, almost bad quality of a 90s mixtape.
I'd say more kind of 90s UK garage, which is having a bit of a renaissance at the moment. I mean, it's incredibly well produced. I'm not sure if he'd necessarily appreciate muted and bad as adjectives.
Well, it's one of those things that it can be quite romantic. Yeah. Let's move on to very finally, I'm afraid, your own track.
Yeah. Well, it's not mine. I wish I was as talented as a producer. But no, I recently started a label about a year ago, which has been, you know, very, very exciting, with George Fitzgerald, whose track you just heard. He's my partner with the label. And this is our latest release, a very mysterious producer called You. And the track's called Aya.
Nikhil Shah, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on The Review.
Thank you very much.
That was Aya by You, the choice of Nikhil Shah, co-founder of the online music service Mixcloud, and today's music review guest on today's review.
Well, earlier we heard Nelly Gacheva's cultural tour of the globe, but now it's time to take a closer look at what's on offer in one specific city. And today it's Buenos Aires, where Monocle correspondent Ed Stocker is your guide.
Spring is in the air here in Buenos Aires, and so are the smoky sounds of jazz. The capital will be graced with the finest local and international acts from Wednesday. The International Jazz Festival runs until November the 26th. Check out the Tom Harrell Quintet playing on the opening night in the magnificent Usina del Arte venue. For Shakespeare fans, the ongoing production of Macbeth at the Teatro San Martin is not to be missed. Seen the Bard's plays in English? Now it's time to see if it works in Spanish or gets lost in translation. A visually stunning production that has been extremely well received here, on until November the 30th. There's a lot more than just red meat to the Argentinian diet, and the Feria Masticar, chew fair in English, on all weekend in El Dorrego, is the first event of its kind curated by local chefs. Here's a chance to try restaurant food at decent prices, take cooking classes, and learn about healthy seasonal produce. The entrance fee is 30 pesos. It's time to travel northwards, to Mexico more specifically. From midday today, Buenos Aires is celebrating the best of Mexican music and art through its Revolución Mexicana festival. There's traditional dancing and mariachi bands, as well as more modern sounds. Have a listen to the boleros and cumbias of Los Paquitos. De los Barrios Arte is a charming documentary that comes to the big screen this weekend. The 40-minute film focuses on painters living and working in the western neighborhoods of Buenos Aires, looking at everything from their inspirations to the financial difficulties of being an artist. a fascinating window into a slice of Porteño life.
Un artista genuino es como el encargado de dar la memoria y la expresión de la humanidad.
For Monaco and Buenos Aires, I'm Ed Stocker.
Era precisamente lo que se vivía en esa época.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back after this to talk experimental music and sonic art. Stay tuned if you dare.
Wherever you're going this winter, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companion. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Barts, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just go to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. It's Saturday, so you must be listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
And to finish today's show, we're going to venture into the world of contemporary music and sound art. Be not afraid, we have a wise and experienced guide. Just getting underway in the north of the United Kingdom is the Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival, the UK's largest international festival of new and experimental music, which has been going for over 30 years. That's once annually, not continuously. Trek still further from the equator and you'll reach Glasgow, where the first ever Sonica Festival of International Sonic Art is just drawing to a close.
Well, Igor Turini-Lalic is classical music editor for theartsdesk.com. He's been at both events in Glasgow and also in Huddersfield, and he joins us now from Huddersfield. Igor, a very warm welcome to The Review. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of what was being shown or played at both Huddersfield and Glasgow, just explain very broadly what this genre entails.
It's the first time Sonic has been held up in Glasgow, and essentially they're dedicated to celebrating sound art in the broadest definition of that term. So that's sort of artists who are interested in sound and composers who are interested in art. And they share, Huddersfield and Sonica share an artistic director. So several things that happen in Sonica also happen in Huddersfield. And there's a visual art theme running through Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival this year as well.
Sticking with the idea of sound art, give us an example, if you will, at Sonica in Glasgow. What was a particular highlight as far as you were concerned?
Well, there's this Korean artist called Mukyung Shin, who did a very effective installation piece at the tramway, where he created a sort of symphony out of the act of wrapping knuckles and fingers on a table. So you have a glass hand that creates this sort of five-note figure, which is just the wrap, and it's extended across huge space, multiplied by sort of 1,000 hands, and you know, delivered in various combinations. That was one of the best pieces. It's a sort of less is more is really the key to getting sound art right, and he really, you know, hit the nail on the head with that one.
Let's have a little listen to it. That was a piece by the Korean artist Mukyung Shin.
The sound might seem a bit monotonous, and that is part of the piece, but you have to also see this kind of visual spectacle of 5,000 hands wrapping in front of you. It's quite spectacular.
Igor, that does lead me to believe, how important is it to have something visual? I mean, Sonica in Glasgow is being described as sonic art for the visually minded. How crucial is it to have a context or something to look at in order to enjoy the sound?
Well, I think it's increasingly important. I mean, I think it's a realm that's, you know, developing and more and becoming more and more sophisticated and more interesting for a younger generation that has this visual component to their lives. So, yeah, it's kind of, I went to a concert, a sort of bog standard concert last night, and it seemed pretty dry and old fashioned. I sort of wanted some element of visual interplay to happen. And it's necessary in Sonic Art for the visual to have as much interest as the sound.
Doesn't that slightly blur the boundary, though, between Sonic Art and then just pure performance or installation art?
Yeah, the boundaries are very blurred. This is a fuzzy grey area, but this is the kind of exciting thing about it. in a way, most of the sort of interesting things that are happening in music are happening in this strange world called sound art. Because in a way, there's just much more freedom in sort of contemporary classical music. It's still very confined by the notated score, still can be very academic. But in sound art, and they have John Cage, I guess, as their god, you know, you are much freer to do what you like and to engage in how things behave in a space and look in a space, which I think is really important.
Freedom in any artistic sense is a bit of a double-edged sword, though. Is there a people, I think, often need to work within parameters for things to be comprehensible to most of their audience? How does one guard against the perils of self-indulgence, I guess, is what I'm asking in this context?
Yeah, well, I don't think you can guard against it. There will be self-indulgence. There was self-indulgence, for sure. You have to allow for that. There will always be those who step too far over the edge. But I tell you that it's much more exciting, and I think people are much more excited by the sounds that are produced in this world called sound art than they are in the world called contemporary classical music, which seems to be far narrower and far more rule-bound. So actually, I think, you know, this freedom, yeah, for sure. For example, I mean, there were several duds. I mean, there was an opera by Claudia Molitor that just was a complete failure. But, you know, you've got to have the failures to have the successes.
Just give us a brief overview of what you thought of Sonica. It's the first festival to be held in Glasgow of this kind.
It's fantastic. I mean, it's really necessary, I think, to bring together this art form that is sort of spread across various genres. I mean, some of it can be found in theatres, some of it can be found in the cinema, some of it can be found in art galleries. And to bring all these sound art practitioners together into one festival is fantastic, and I'd say sort of 70% of the shows were completely brilliant, and many premieres, very exciting things happening. It's one to watch. I think it'll grow and grow.
Let's move on to another choice of yours, Daniel Skoglund and Kathy Hind, a piece called Palimpsest, which we'll talk about in a moment, but having seen a little clip of it, it requires a very large amount of visual attention as well as listening. Let's have a listen.
That was Daniel Skoglund and Kathy Hind's Palimpsest, which does seem a bit like random context-free noise without the visual accompaniment. Igor, what are we looking at while we're hearing that?
It is sort of random context-less noise, but it's very complicatedly done. Daniel Skoglund, this sound artist from Sweden, has created this strange contraption that circles around on top of a drawing. And as it passes over a line that's been created by Kathy Hind in charcoal or pen, it registers a sound and creates a beat or rhythm. And so they were creating the sounds as we watched. They were actually composing, both the artist Kathy Hind and Daniel Skoglund. It was incredibly exciting. And you suddenly sort of understood the sort of workings of a score, you know, how to create four beats, how to create a smooth transition. You have to be very careful. You have to follow the line of this circling sort of compass point as it tries to pick up the charcoal lines. There were sort of alchemists there, composers there, creating it as we watched. It was very exciting. It was kind of amazing technology. So many uses for it. It might have been a sort of small audience, but I imagine there'll be lots of uses for this technology.
Let's move on to Huddersfield, to the Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival. What was your highlight of that, Igor?
Well, it's just started last night, and Palimpsest was there late last night at the Bates Mill. Just after that was this incredible Norwegian improvisation sound artist, composer called Maya Ratke. And she was creating extraordinary sound, improvised, completely improvised with three other musicians from Norway, this collective called Spunk, and a video artist called Andreas Paleologos. Amazing, simple, Len Lai-like sort of cartoon, very simple abstract images on the huge screen behind them. Essentially, improvisation can be the most self-indulgent of the sort of experimental sound art forms, which is why I was so surprised that I enjoyed this, because I don't usually. It usually takes the same sort of forms, oddly, improvisation at this extreme level. But Maya Ratka has just such an incredible palette of colours, sounds, really incredible, subtle, very carefully created, but intense and huge and epic performance. It was mind-blowing. And the second piece that really impressed me, and actually one of the best pieces I've seen for ages, is a piece at the Huddersfield Art Gallery that is, it looks like nothing really. It's a bit of John Cage provocation in a way, but it is so clever. This is by Johnny Herbert. And this is a composer who's essentially given us a room with several instruments arranged in a circle where we can perform what we like. That's it.
It leads me to my final question, I'm afraid. And forgive me for being a little irreverent. You talk about the fact that you're allowed to go in and make whatever noise you like, and there's also a children's opera happening at Huddersfield. At the risk of sounding cheeky, is this music, this is possibly more easily understood and enjoyed by perhaps the under threes?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I think there are some fundamentals that needs to be sort of re-examined. And I think children do that best often by saying, what's that? Why are you doing it? And essentially, this is what Johnny Herbert is doing with this piece. He's behaving like a three-year-old. He's saying, what is the creative act? The response one has, I mean, my first response was embarrassment for the people who'd gone up to actually play. Because I was thinking this showed an immense arrogance that they thought that they could play something just on the fly. And, you know, then that developed because a girl sat down, all these very kind of contemporary classical people were playing these very subtle little sounds. And then a young teenager just got up to the drum kit and started playing sort of indie pop on her drum kit very, very loudly, just drowning everything else out. It told you so much about, you know, social interaction. Everyone looked stunned, horrified. How dare she sort of interrupt their subtle little squiggles with this noise? And then she got up and left. And then the squiggle started again and people got a bit embarrassed and some people didn't know whether to actually play or not. And maybe this was planted. It re-examined the way we are, you know, why humans interact the way they interact, why they make the creative act at all, whether the creative act is indulgent. It was being the three-year-old and asking fundamental questions about who we are. It was incredible.
Igor Turini-Lalic, classical music editor for theartsdesk.com. Thank you very much indeed for joining us to talk about squiggles. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Saturday Review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. The show today was produced by Katie Bilboa, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Sam Impey.
If you enjoyed the show but can't wait a whole week, Culture with Robert Bound is up on Monday. Here's a clip of what's in store.
I hop the Eurostar to visit Paris Photo, the largest and best photocentric art fair in the world. We'll be sitting down with the authors of two new books, documenting and reflecting on the end of the analogue era of photography. And we'll talk with Monocle's photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, about how to choose who to send where for our magazine.
And we're handing back over to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson.
And Andrew Muller.
Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.